Let me start by defining an empire. It's a transborder, concerted effort to exercise economic, political, culture dominance, pinned up, popped up by military efforts. So it is, if you will, four-dimensional, economic, political, cultural, military. In the particular U.S. case, there is a planner in Pentagon who formulated it much more clearly than I can. In a very famous, very quoted statement, the purpose of the U.S. Army is to make the world safe for American business and for our cultural assault. Full stop. Toward that end, there will be a fair amount of killing. We see that going on right now. I don't think it makes sense to see Fallujah without quoting Directive No. 39 by L.P. Bremer III, that goes to say very clearly the privatization of all businesses owned by the Iraqi state, with the possibility of 100% acquisition by foreigners and 100% repatriation of any profit. The 14 bases being built in Iraq may then serve as an illustration. I think even the Pentagon planner missed out one point. The purpose of the U.S. Army is to make the world safer economic for American business and for political dominance. And in addition to that, for the cultural assault. Now, is it fair amount of killing? The 70 military interventions after 1945 have led to the killing of between 12 and 16 million. That is probably a relatively low estimate. Why is it so imprecise between 12 and 16? Well, it's the difference between overt action and covert action. Let us now say that we have that as a model of what imperialism is about. How would we know that that empire is dead? Well, if we have four dimensions, we have four criteria. And let us say that these are the things that the rest of the world would like to see. Point one, stop killing and withdraw military bases. Point two, stop exploiting. And that means stop extremely unjust, inequitable economic deals. I quoted one example, Directive No. 39 in Iraq, just as one example. But unfortunately, the implications are worse than that, because 125,000 people are dying every day of hunger and easily preventable and curable diseases. If you take that and you multiply it by 360 days, you start coming close to 50 million per year. Now, not all of that is laid at the doorstep of the United States of America. But the interesting thing about the United States of America is that they are the ones who keep the military machinery going that makes it difficult to change it. So when there is an effort to change it, there will very likely be a coup instigated by the U.S. and with a military follow-up. We can now go through the whole post-World War history and document this, and we can ask questions like, why is there an effort to overturn Chavez, but not his predecessor a couple of generations ago, Jimenez? Why the effort to kill Castro, but not Batista? Why is it against the Sandinistas, but not against Somoza? And the answer is very clear. And it lies in the brilliant formulation by the Pentagon planner. So we go on to number three. Join the world. You're not located on a platform named exceptionalism. Join the world, participate in the difficult enterprise of making the world a better place to live for 6.2 billion human beings. The best organization for that today is the UN, with all its shortcomings. You don't step out of the Kyoto Protocol, you invite a conference to revise it. if you have grievances, and there are shortcomings in that protocol. You don't step out of the ABM treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty. You come up with a system that provides the same level of security as that one did. You don't step out of it and introducing the NMD instead. Join the world means that you see yourself as a normal country. And that leads to the cultural aspect of the empire. Give up the idea of being a chosen people by God with a direct mandate. And that you somehow have the solution to all problems. The antidote, the opposite of this, is called dialogue. In other words, to get backwards, dialogue. For the political aspect, participation. For the economic aspect, equity. And then how about the military aspect? Instead of seeing security problems all over, and there are some security problems, shift your attention. See conflicts all over the place. And instead of building strength, try to solve them. It's possible. It can be done. But in order to do it, you have to give up one idea, namely that the other party is born evil, will continue, remain evil, and that the only remedy is to crush and exterminate. Unfortunately, these four aspects hang together. So I think what the world is demanding is, in one sense, a tall bill. In another sense, not that terribly difficult. Stop killing, withdraw your bases, have equitable economic deals, join the world for all its multilateralism and slowliness, and enter into dialogue with a fascinating variety of civilizations. Can be done. Most countries try to do it, more or less perfectly. If this should happen, the greatest beneficiary from the decline and fall of the U.S. empire would be United States of America. It would blossom. Why? Well, first of all, it would get rid of an enormous economic burden. All of us know a little bit about the costs of empire in economic terms. But secondly, it would get rid of an enormous amount of fear. And that fear is based on a mechanism which is ridiculously simple. One day all these people that we have bossed and bullied and killed will come back and do the same to us. Since there have been 240 military interventions since Thomas Jefferson started in Libya, there are lots of people who might dream of vengeance. In order to get out of that, you withdraw your tentacles and you start processes of reconciliation. Let me give an example. Germany occupied 25 countries during Nazism and tried to exterminate three nations. The Jews, the Sinti Roma, and the Slavs. They had a program for eliminating 100 million Slavs, 50 million by killing and 50 million by starvation. Mainly Russian Slavs, to empty the territory for a German colony. Well, they took 26 million Russians, 6 million Jews, and an unspecified number of Sinti Roma. If you take 25 occupied countries plus three nations, you get 28. Today, Germany has good relations to, practically speaking, all 28. What I've said so far is that an empire is a very clear construct. There's no mystery what it is about. And it is the synergy between the four dimensions that makes it. The abolition of the empire is not a question of hoisting and unhoisting a flag at midnight. That was the old way of doing it. Four very clear demands. And they're very reasonable. Point three. The greatest beneficiary will be United States of America. And I stand on exactly the same line as Gore Vidal. I love the U.S. Republic and I hate the U.S. Empire. And please never fall into the temptation of calling somebody who criticizes the U.S. empire anti-American. It's exactly because we foreigners make that distinction that we're in a position to be honest and say what I exactly said. There are public opinion polls among Muslims showing that more than 80% reject U.S. foreign policy and more than 80% admire United States of America. It's entirely consistent. You can say, don't you get into difficulties when you see the number of people who support Bush? Well, we get into some small difficulties. But you can have difficulties with all countries, you see, including my own, little Norway. But I am perfectly capable of loving my country without admiring Quisling. And I can love Russia without admiring Stalin. In order to make those distinctions, you actually need only two cells in your brain. But if you have only one cell in your brain, it starts getting problematic. So let us now take this construct, the U.S. empire, and then we introduce an approach to social science called dialectic. Don't confuse it with Marxism. Marxism was a very poor type of dialectic. It's a Chinese concept. Don't confuse it with Greece, with Greeks, with Heraclitus. It is Taoism. It's yin yang. To every force there is a counterforce. Don't confuse it with Newton. There's no guarantee it will be exactly opposite and that it will be of the same magnitude, but it will be a counterforce. Which incidentally is a reason that the worst game a political elite can play is golf. Because it's a linear agenda. You see those 18 holes? Fill them. Now in the real world, the holes move. They make alliances. They cover up. They shoot the ball back. And worse, suddenly the 18 holes surround the player, starting digging a hole, a quagmire for the player to fall into. Well, that's what the world is like. Now, put the politician into a golf course, and you get an incompetent one as a result. That doesn't mean that he cannot do it in brilliant short time, but he's in for some surprises called dialectic. I have a list here of 14 counterforces to the U.S. empire. But I'll first make propaganda for my predictive ability. In 1980, I made a prediction with a list of 5 counterforces against the Soviet empire. That the Berlin Wall will fall within 10 years, and the Soviet empire will follow. One of the places I made that prediction was in Moscow. It was not excessively popular. But one guy came up to me afterwards and said, what makes you think that we will last as much as 10 years? Why, what makes you think that? So I said, well, you know, these 5 contradictions need their time to synergize and synchronize and work themselves through the system. And he said, 5, there are many more, but I don't care to tell you. Well, it fell. It happened. I can mention to you which the 5 were. Number 1, it's very simple. Between Soviet Union and the satellites who wanted independence. Number 2, between Russia and the other parts of the Soviet Union who wanted autonomy. Number 3, between town and countryside in the Soviet construction. Number 4, between the socialist bourgeoisie and the socialist working class. And number 5, between liquidity and lack of goods. And you can then see all these 5 working. How about freedom? Well, freedom is in the first 2. How about human rights? In the first 2, maybe the 3rd 2. It's only that for me to talk about a contradiction, there have to be concrete social forces. Not words, but forces. I can now read for you the 14, but I'd rather take them first in groups. Economic, military, political, and cultural contradictions. You guessed that one, because those are the 4 dimensions of imperialism. And then there is something I call social contradictions, which are concrete social forces building up. And among them I have between state and capital elites and working classes of unemployed and contract workers, on the one hand, And on the second hand, between the older and middle generation and youth. I have this in two ways, in the global scene and domestically in the U.S. But let us now simply get started with economic contradictions. I have three. Between growth and distribution, between productive and finance economy, and between production, distribution, consumption, and nature. Start with the third one. Peak oil. In an economy desperately in need of oil, with very few serious attempts to move in other directions, with a peak oil phenomenon of increasing costs and increasing difficulties finding exploitable places, there will be increasing military warfare to conquer the places. Many of them are in Central Asia. Hence, contradiction number six, which is with the biggest countries in Asia, Russia, China, and India. The oil fields border on them. They are also hungry for oil. It's 40% of humanity. So number three spills into number six. I just give it as an example of the type of synergies you get when you list the contradictions. Climatic changes, global warming. The way in which the U.S. is held accountable exactly by stepping out of the Kyoto Protocol. And you will, of course, remember that people are not necessarily very subtle. When you get into the habit of blaming U.S., U.S. will be blamed for everything. Sometimes even I will come up and say, look, 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 that's going a little bit too far. No, not that one. There are some other crooks in the world. Not all the crooks live in Washington. You have to have a more diverse perspective on the world. At this point, there was a guy called ABB, anybody but Bush. He was also known as John F. Kerry, who had, I think, a very good program in this particular field. Very good and admirable program. I would guess that very many Americans agreed with him on that one, but they didn't have top priority. Other things had top priority. What? Well, I'll give you my best hunch. This is a footnote, an aside. If you believe that you are the chosen people by God, then you would also believe that God protects you. If God protects you, 9/11 would never have happened. It means God did not protect you. Because he would have stopped the planes in the air, like the kamikaze wind that came and stopped the Mongol invasion of sun goddess-protected Japan at the end of the 13th century. Anyhow, 9/11 happened. Why? Because Americans hadn't kept their side of the covenant. What was the covenant? Ten Commandments. What do Americans do? Same-sex marriage and abortion. Californication. So given that, what is the way to regain God's protection? Now, what could be more important than God's protection? And then some guy comes and starts talking about windmills. Yeah? Solar collectors. Sounds like petty stuff relative to moral and family values. But I'm then saying that I don't think those moral and family values were just norms to regulate social intercourse. I'm saying that it had a deeper existential fundamentalist rooting, and that that is the country in which we are in this moment, right now. Number two was between productive and finance economy. It works the following way. That if you have a very rapid growth in the finance economy, meaning the stocks are doing fine, the dollar is surging. But at the same time, you have nothing corresponding in the productive economy, but a sluggish economy with a low growth rate. Then the asynchrony between finance economy and productive economy will hit back and take the form of a crash. Last time that happened was 2001, between the so-called new economy and the reality. It's the gap between the finance economy and a productive economy. I predicted it 2 years ahead of time, and I have one advantage in my life. I'm not trained as an economist, so it is so much easier to see reality. When you have to see it through the type of crazy training these guys get, it becomes very difficult. I admire any economist who nevertheless could talk sense. There are not many of them, but it happens. So, having said that sweet, charming little how-to-make-friends remark, then let me just say the following. I think the U.S. is in for a rather major crash, and I'll give you one hint. Whenever you read that Dow Jones is going up, you are closer to the crisis. Unless there is a corresponding surge in the productive economy, which there will not be. One particular financial instrument has taken the dive already, the dollar. What does this mean? That there is no confidence in the dollar, given that 60% of the dollar, the U.S. bonds, are owned by a couple of Asian economies, that China and Japan are financing the war in Iraq, that the deficit is, as you know, both the fiscal and the total deficit are enormous and increasing all the time, $2 billion per day. Given that, you have lack of confidence. This lack of confidence will then increase exponentially to a possible free fall. Now, how is the country going to overcome that? There are two possibilities. One is the official one that any economist, any bookkeeper can point out. You use the cheap dollar in order to increase your exports. What's wrong about that one? What's wrong about that one is what I call the social contradictions. And it may not be very well known in the U.S., but the point is simply the following, that there is today an economic boycott of U.S. goods spreading very quickly around the world. It was reported by Lester Brown recently that 8 of the 10 leading U.S. product brands are American. More than half the sales of each of these brands are outside the United States. The Financial Times reports that some of the world's strongest consumer brands, like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Gap, are being hit hard. Coca-Cola sales in Germany dropped 16% from the similar period last year. McDonald's is in crisis. Disney World in Paris is bankrupt. GM and Ford in Germany are about to close, and so on, so on. Now, this is not good news. If you want to strengthen your economy by more export. There's much more to come. And I'm not going to report all of that. I'm just going to say that this is not an organized boycott. It's much worse. It is a feeling of disgust. And this feeling of disgust makes Coca-Cola taste bad. There are medical reasons for that. An idiotizing, fattening, tepid, seeping liquid. But leaving those aside, this feeling is spreading. In order to understand that feeling better, we have to look at those data that you all know, more or less, about how did people vote when they were asked, how would you vote if you were an American and were participating in the elections today? Well, you have probably seen it. It's reported. It is a world map with the votes, and it's correctly made, red and blue. It's a strange distribution of colors. We are not used to that one in Europe that way, but anyhow, we can take many things. Of all the countries outside Europe on this map, there were three countries favorable to Bush. The other ones were all favorable to ABB. And the countries favorable to Bush were Poland, the Philippines, and Nigeria. India was about equal. Now, Poland and Philippines have one thing in common with Bush. Together with America, those are the countries that get the highest score. If you add up the number of people who believe in God and the number of people who believe in Satan. If you do that for the U.S., you have to add 94 and 71, and you get, of course, 164. 65. If you take similar processes for Poland and Philippines, you get about the same. But the U.S. is number one in believing in Satan. There's no other country in the world that believes that much in Satan. And in the Chicago Tribune's report, which was reported in the Yomiuri Shimbun in Japan the 3rd of January this year, it is pointed out very clearly that by Satan, the pollsters made it very clear it's somebody who is on full-time duty and interferes in your daily life. Now, Michael Moore's point that Americans are a frightened race, I think misses a point. It misses the theological underpinning. So what I am saying that I can explain Philippines and Poland theologically. And you should not see it as political allegiance. So, I take it as a theological statement. Nigeria, I simply don't understand. So, India can understand. Was a tie. The common enemy of the Muslims. That, I think, makes some kind of political sense. And has, of course, been the Bush administration's effort to circumvent the alliance formation between Russia, India, and China. An alliance formation which eventually will cost the U.S. very dearly. Well, having said this, I am saying that the sentiment is of such a kind that people are not going to buy American goods. That means the export market is limited to what governments buy, because they don't dare boycott, because they might be bombed. Whereas a private guy who passes Esso, Texaco, Mobil, and not to forget Shell, and just goes on to the local pump, it's very difficult to bomb him. So the way they do it with governments is to more or less coerce them to buy arms. In order to be able to sell arms, you have to produce insecurity first. At that, the U.S. can be relied upon for producing the insecurity that at least stimulates the arms trade. But having said that, even the most lapdog-inclined government starts understanding the trick now. Resistance builds up. So having said that, I have mentioned difficulty with method number one in handling the weak dollar. What's method number two? You could do it with a very simple decree. You change the dollar bill overnight, and anybody who has old dollars, goodbye. If you want to redeem your bonds, try come and get it. In other words, it may be that those bonds can be written off as a loss. 92% of the U.S. deficit is covered by foreigners. 60% of it is covered by Asian countries, essentially Japan and China. Japan and China are covering the wars of the United States of America in order to guarantee their export markets, to make U.S. solvent enough to pay for the products they buy. Well, there is, of course, yet another method, which is to say, not only we export more, or we change the currency and you're not going to get it anyhow, and the third one would be to import less. Now, try that with an impoverished American working class to deprive them of Chinese goods. Cheap East Asian goods. I don't think that is very workable. So imagine you screw the working class, you shift the wealth upward to the top 20% or 1% for that matter. You have the consumer price index rise more than the salary index, the wages index rises. You make the situation deteriorate, like the data show. So what do you pay people when you don't pay them dollars? Well, you can pay them Jesus currency. You can say that believe in Jesus and God will protect us against. You can also pay them cheap Chinese goods. So imagine you cut off that possibility. Well, then you're left with Jesus currency. This is another method called redistribution. It's not being to be done by the Bush administration. The country is in a squeeze. The basic point about economic boycott is not the decline in profit. The basic point is the moral challenge. That will get to the USA the way it did to South Africa. U.S. companies abroad make an average profit of 6%. That means a 6% boycott is sufficient to make them reconsider their overseas investment. And that's the magnitude we have for the brands I mentioned. Some will ask for U.S. military intervention. And since this is done by private people and not by governments, it's not easy. South Africa was in that situation, and both Mandela and the last white president told me that what hit us and what worked was not the boycott of apples, that was not important for our economy at all, but it was the moral message, the message of disgust. Foreign students coming to U.S. went down 2.4% last year. There are many interpretations. One of them is U.S. foreign policy. My wife and I passed into Los Angeles Airport 2 days ago, fingerprinting on both index fingers and the iris scrutinized by some interesting device. I did not like it, and I say it with no smile. I didn't like it at all. So, let's go down the list. I mentioned the distribution and through with the economic factors. Let me take the next list, which is Ford, and those are the military contradictions. So by contradiction, we mean that the U.S. is pushing in one direction, and lo and behold, there is a counter-push. Contradiction number four, and this is a list that I made in 1999 and made public in 2000 with a prediction that the U.S. empire is gone by year 2025. You'll remember my boasting of my Soviet prediction. Bush was elected in year 2000, and I reduced it by 5 years after having watched him for a couple of months and defined him as a so-called accelerator of the synergies and the synchronies. He is now re-elected. I have reduced it by 5 more years. So we are now down to year 2015. Number four is between U.S. state terrorism and terrorism. It is almost unbelievable that an elite can believe that you can behave the way, kill that many people, and there will be no reaction. It doesn't work that way. So let us say that you multiply by every person killed by U.S. forces by a factor of 10. The number of friends, family, those who are bereaved and feel something in their heart, a sting. So suddenly you're up to not 12 to 16 million, but 150 million. It's rather unbelievable that some of those 150 million, for instance, 19 Arabs, shouldn't get the idea of doing something about it. And yet my interpretation of 9/11 is somewhat deeper than pure revenge. My interpretation of 9/11 is the public execution of two buildings, not the people in it. I don't think that was important to them. I think it was the buildings. For having sinned against Allah. For having intervened militarily, established bases with Jews and Christians in them. And on top of that, for having foisted upon a Wahhabite Saudi Arabia a consumerist lifestyle that they did not see as theirs. So if you look at it this way, it looks like we are caught in a vicious cycle between terrorism and state terrorism. How does that work right now? I mentioned that 5 countries were pulling out of the coalition of the willing. They have become unwilling. 6 countries in NATO have refused to train Iraqi officers. The numbers 5 and 6 will grow quickly. I don't have time to go into that. I'm just saying that the prediction is that the U.S. will be very alone. It's going badly, and that means that those who love the U.S. Republic are interested in how do we help U.S. get out. We're not concerned with getting out with honor. We're not concerned with that. But getting out in a way that in one sense teaches the US a lesson, but in the other sense does something much more important. An Iraq that could function. I'll tick off points. By countries like Japan and European Union establishing contact with the Iraqi resistance, with the aim of having a conference for security and cooperation in the Middle East after the model of the Helsinki Conference, United States as an observer, and as a possible point on the agenda, an Iraqi federation with Kuwait as an associated member, independent country, as a federation with democracy and human rights. But the Kurds, who right now are the ones who have benefited from what has happened, having their part. The Sunnis having their part by giving up the idea of being the instrument through which foreigners can run Iraq. And the Shias having an Islamic Republic in their part, but giving up the idea of running all of Iraq, according to that pattern. Now the key to this is a federation. The obvious precondition is very simple. All foreigners out. All the decrees made by the U.S. administration and puppet administration declared null and void. You start from the beginning with a free Iraq. It's a tall bill. When Iraq is mentioned, the word Vietnam often comes up. I remember so clearly in the 1970s, where everybody said that if the U.S. withdraws, there will be civil war and chaos in Iraq. In Vietnam. They managed it extremely well. I go on to the next one, which is United States relative to the Allies. Well, the Allies are falling off. And they are rather important countries. We are right now, of course, mainly talking about Germany, France, Spain. And I could go through the rest of the list and make some predictions. Number six is Russia, India, China. This could be the seat of the Fourth World War that Norman Podoritz is writing about in commentary in the September issue. They are coming closer than ever. The U.S. had a chance as long as the BJP was in power in India, because the BJP had given up two of Nehru's dictums, secularism and non-alignment. They went in for Hindutva and were contemplating a NATO for Asia with the United States. They lost the elections to a large extent for that reason. That was not captured by the mainstream press. Well, as I said, 40% of humanity. United States is 6%. If you now go on to number seven, NATO versus the European Union army. This is not necessarily to say that it is an independence declaration of the United States, which of course it is. But it's also to say that the European Union should be watched as a possible imperial successor. I'm afraid of that one. But for the United States, it means that there is an alternative source. And that countries, one after the other, will leave NATO, not formally but informally, and go to the European Union. Let me just add that of the 25 countries that Germany had occupied and brutalized during the Second World War, 18 are members of the European Union together with Germany. That's quite something. United States will have to revise quite a lot of textbooks, which was the German approach, in order to create friends among the countries they have brutalized. Number eight. United States, United Nations. That it is tense, we know. The rift between UN and the US will not only be France, it will be much more universal. Okay, number 10, 11, 12, cultural contradictions. Judaism, Christianity on the one side against Islam. There are 1.3 billion Muslims. And they have this unfortunate habit of not accepting the borders that we have been drawing in the sand of the desert and things of that type. It's high time we learned that. But leaving that point aside, the tragedy of this religious divide, of religion so similar, with so much beauty in all three of them, mobilizing the fundamentalists on both sides. Where the U.S. union of Jewish and Christian fundamentalism is intellectually brilliant, as far as I've understood it, reading Rapture books and other books. And once being visiting professor at the University of Virginia and Duke University, and each week traveling between Duke and University of Virginia, passing through Lynchburg. Now, the name is not very promising, but the cafeteria conversations are fantastic. And they brought me up to date with Armageddon each time I bought a hamburger. And I was willing to buy more than one hamburger in order to be in on biblical time. What I found, incidentally, in the footnote, was that my distinguished American colleagues didn't know their own country. They were living in some ghettos called Harvard and Yale and California, Berkeley, and places like that. Not the slightest contact with their own country. Okay, Lynchburg prevailed. But leaving that aside, how did the Jews and the Christians come together as fundamentalists? As far as I understand, by abolishing the old contradiction between not accepting Jesus as Messiah on the Jewish side and seeing Jesus as God's Son on the Christian side. And the formula was simple. The second coming of Jesus Christ is the first coming of Messiah. Absolutely brilliant from the point of view of engineering a coalition. But it leaves out Islam. Anybody who can build bridges between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam deserves more than one Nobel Peace Prize. Now, these bridges are attempted built in this European Union OIC flirtatious exercise. And it will, of course, take place. But the European Union at the same time has very close cooperation with ASEAN, and they are silently, softly fomenting an East Asian community of the Mahayana Buddhist Confucian countries, Japan, the Korean Peninsula, China, Taiwan, of course, maybe Vietnam. In 1999, they had the first conference. Why is there a Western European community and not an East Asian community? I'm not going into the debate, I'll just say these things are coming. And these are among the things that U.S. resents most, an East Asian community. Now, dear Washington, there's a handwriting on the wall. Read it. Don't try to fight it. It'll come, whatever you do. If you try to resist it, it'll come a little bit sooner. Join it. Welcome it. And maybe one day there will be not only one euro, but one Asia as a currency. Maybe one day it will be a global currency, but it will not be dollar. That will not be the global currency. Its days are past. They have peaked. Now, having said that, there are two others that are not so significant but important. There are other civilizations that feel trampled upon by the U.S., not only Islam. It is Hinduism, it is Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism in China. It is the Andean civilizations, the Inca, the Mexican Aztecs, the Mayas. There are grumblings and rumblings in all those places. And the signals are nothing good for Washington. This is, of course, also true for number 12. The European elite culture. The tremendous strength of U.S. culture has been its vulgarity, its guaranteed plebeian nature. It's reaching everybody. But that not in an evil sense of the vulgarity of the Coca-Cola and the hamburger, but also its universalism and generosity, and its way of embracing everybody if they're willing to play the game, the way it has been defined by the U.S. This is a weak one. the contradictions that are most important are growth versus distribution, productive versus finance economy, economy versus nature, terrorism versus state terrorism, U.S. versus Russia, India, China, U.S. versus UN, U.S. versus European Union, Judaism, Christianity versus Islam, and the world opposition. Now, the biggest demonstration in human history was, of course, the 12 million people, the 15th of February last year, in 600 places in the world, organized by the World Social Forum, Porto Alegre, Bombay. To have 12 million people come out in 600 places and then be wiped off the historical screen by Bush saying these are focus groups. The conclusion drawn by people all over the world is that the U.S. is not going to listen to words. Other languages have to be used. The solution of speaking with violence is not one generally accepted. Economic boycott then becomes a natural way of doing it. Okay, if you don't listen, we are not going to take you on and in. In that there is a message, and you will read it. Sooner or later it'll come to you. How does this work now in practice? Well, I'll tell you a little story from my own family. When I was 15, 1945, my sister and her coming husband had been fighting very much against the German occupation, like we all did. I was almost peeing in my pants, carrying illegal papers to school, distributing to another guy and things of that kind. She came back, having barely managed to escape to Sweden, came back in October 45, to the great delight of my parents and myself. And they announced we had become communists. I did not quite understand what this communist stuff was. But I asked my sister, why are you, what was it again, communist? And she said, for two reasons. The war against Nazi Germany was not won by England and America. It was won by the Soviet Army. They were the ones who sacrificed. What the Anglo-Americans did was to kill, kill, kill in bombing. Point two, Soviet Union is the only country that has taken the bottom of society seriously and attended to their health and education, and so on. And I had learned something about dictatorship, so I said that, having been through the war, and she said, yes, that's true, but that's only a phase. Okay, so now the following happened. The first book denouncing the Soviet Union and revealing the truth of Stalinism was by a Ukrainian called Igor Kravchenko, who became a refugee in Canada. And his book was called I Chose Freedom. Now remember now that this was long before Solzhenitsyn. And you must see me as a 15 years old boy. And I'm now observing my beloved sister. She took that book and threw it in the wall. Bang! Whereupon she picked it up and started reading. Phase one, total denial. It's all lies. Phase two, this Kravchenko is a traitor. It's probably paid by somebody. Phase three, okay, there is something to it. But it's only because of Stalin. You get rid of Stalin and everything will be okay. Phase four, okay, it was not only Stalin, something in the structure was wrong. One party, dictatorship for the proletariat. Okay, phase five. The whole idea was wrong around the beginning. And then comes quite often phase six. Blind anti-Sovietism. Totally incapable of appreciating some of the good things they did. Like supporting anti-colonial war. About all of these, you can ask question marks. And there's a yin and a yang, and a yin and a yang to the yin, and a yang and a yin to the yang, and you did. And all of that is complicated once you start analyzing it. But I lived through these phases in two persons I loved. I see exactly the same all over Europe now in relation to the United States. The really U.S. philiacs will deny every sentence in what I have just said. Next phase, I'm a traitor. That's probably because he didn't get the position. He wanted to get foreign minister, and fortunately he is not. So that's the reason why he talks the way he did. Look, I'm totally satisfied with the power that I have in the world, and I wouldn't like it decreased by becoming foreign minister in a small country. Now, point three. This is not about the U.S., it's about Bush. And if he could only get rid of Bush, everything would be okay. Yeah? And if you have been protected by lack of knowledge about the country you have adored and which has so many adorable characteristics, as I have mentioned, the U.S. Republic, then you don't know that Kerry might even in some regards have been worse. Point four, there's something wrong in the whole structure. And up comes the anti-capitalist critique. Up comes the anti-Pentagon, anti-military critique. Point five, there's something wrong in the whole culture. And that's when you start looking at this chosen people kind of business. My friends, what's happening now around the world is that people are going through these stages. And they go through them quickly. I think it's important that it doesn't end in blind anti-Americanism. So I stop at that point and the debate starts. Thank you.